The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this 7-day sesshin here in July 2015 at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico. And I'd like to share with you some of the teachings of a woman I met many years ago, 1995, in Bogaya. At the time, she was in her 20s. She was the daughter of a highly renowned meditation master in the couple of Tibetan traditions, Buddhist traditions. And we kind of hit it off. Haven't seen her since, although we passed close by when I was teaching in Santa Fe, and later that afternoon she was teaching at the same place in Santa Fe. Her name is Khandro Rinpoche, and she was fluent in English. She was born in India, in Dharamsala, I believe, into a very, in a sense, rarefied atmosphere, with her father being such an important teacher, and I believe her mother was too. She was trained initially by her father from a very young age, and as I said, she was a lovely, lovely person and very deep in her understanding. This is a book called This Precious Life, Tibetan Buddhist Teachings on the Path to Enlightenment. And in it, she speaks of the four reminders, they're called, in Tibetan Buddhism. And the first reminder is that this life is very precious. It's incredibly precious because it's only from this life that we can come to awakening. It's in this life that we have the capacity, the understanding, the ability, and if we're fortunate enough, we've come into contact with the teachings as well. And then the rest of it is up to us. We assume often that to come to awakening is to get into some special mind state. But actually it's our natural state of mind without the incrustations of greed, anger, and delusion that have accumulated over lifetimes of ignorant living. Little by little, step by step, we can open to that innate wisdom and compassion that we possess, that is us, really. It's more than a possession, it's who we are. It takes a great deal of effort, it takes a great deal of work, it's not instantaneous. And although most people these days want instant results, we're not going to get it really with the practice. However, if we stick it out, it's going to make an enormous difference in our lives. The trajectory that our lives would take if we do practice is very different from one that it would follow if we don't. And that is why this life is so precious, because we have a chance here to make a difference. I'd like to share with you a few words first of a Tibetan teaching called This Precious Life. Actually, it's called The Four Reminders. And I'm going to just jump around here because I won't take the whole thing. This human existence with all its freedoms and endowments is extremely difficult to attain. There is a Hindu saying that after a human life, one takes 50,000, I think it is, lives as a bird. We don't have to buy into any of that, but the point is we're alive now and we have a chance now to practice. And it can make a big difference in our lives. And not only in our lives, but the lives of all beings, really, because we are so, it's much more than interconnected. although in appearance there is separation between each of us and the rest of the world, the rest of the things in the world, in reality, there really isn't, and science is beginning to catch up with this. It's known that there is more space, for example, in a human body than there are cells. And among those cells, more than half of them are apparently not our body cells. They are the cells of hangers-on. There are cells of critters that live within our body that help us survive. And they talk. There's much talk these days about gut bacteria and gut creatures, and having the right assortment of them. And it's now even thought that not having the right assortment of them can lead to Parkinson's, which is considered a neurological disease. And it's hard to know at this point what the real story is, except that there are more and more reports of people healing from intransigent illnesses through adding particular probiotics, they call them, to their intestinal tract. And one of the most recent and to some people amusing ones is for people who have a great deal of problem with their intestinal system, to import the poop from someone else that has a better arrangement of flora has been shown to actually make a very positive difference and can even cure people of certain conditions. So, to even be born is pretty phenomenal, and then to survive past childhood is more so, and by the time we get to growing older into adulthood and older than that, it's a question of how long we will survive. We've just recently learned that the first person to be ordained here at Mountain Gate has died at the young age of 34 in a car accident. When I went to the meeting in Bogaya, at which I met Khandur Rinpoche, in a way the theme became death. India being India, although we thought we had made full arrangements ahead of time, when we arrived in India and were picked up by the people who were supposed to have made our plane reservation or our train reservations and arranged for us to stay in a monastery, everything had changed. They had not made reservations for whatever reason. We never found out why not. But we finally were able to get reservations, but not for a couple of days later. If we had arrived when we had originally planned to arrive, a few days ahead of the conference, we might not have survived, because that very night, two foreigners in that very small town of Bogaya were murdered. And so that was the beginning of our arrival at this. It was a meeting, the first and I think only at this point still, of Western Buddhist ordained women. And it took place at the Burmese Vihara in Bodhgaya, India. Bodhgaya being the place where the Buddha came to awakening under what is now known as the Enlightenment Tree or the Bodhi Tree. Then what followed, as soon as we arrived, and other people also were delayed, as it turns out, so the thing didn't start on time after all. But more than that, there was a French Buddhist nun who was riding in a rickshaw in Delhi when it was struck by a truck. And she was injured extremely seriously. And in fact, she wasn't expected to live, and in the end she didn't anyway. She had a great deal of brain damage, and for the first 2 weeks of the conference, other women who knew her personally traveled back and forth from Delhi in kind of relay, because Delhi was 24 hours away by train, to help take care of her in the hospital. And then she did die. And then shortly before the conference ended, after 3.5 weeks, I got a fax from my brother saying that our father was dying, in a word, that he had quit eating. And my brother had enlightenedly asked the nursing home where he was to basically just be there for him, to offer him food and drink if he wanted it, not to force it on him, and have someone there to hold his hand. And my father had Parkinson's, and it was quite advanced by that time, to the point where he was choking on his food, which is, I'm sure, why he chose not to eat. It wasn't a pleasant experience. Who would have wanted to do that anyway? And he was in his 80s and essentially legally blind and with almost no hearing. And there wasn't a lot for him to live for anyway, particularly not if he was going to choke on food. And so he simply quit eating. And by the time I got to Delhi after the conference, he had died. On the way to Gaya, where we would take the train to Delhi from Bodh Gaya, we passed a corpse in the street. This life truly is precious, and we really don't know how long we'll live. It's important to, as the American saying goes, make hay while the sun shines. And that potential is innate in each of us. To open even a bit to the innate freedom that we are endowed with. Freedom from anger, freedom from greed, freedom from delusion, freedom from knee-jerk reactions to life. This is what our practice offers to us. This human existence with all its freedoms and endowments is extremely difficult to attain. It enables one to accomplish the meaning of one's being. Having attained such a precious existence, if one does not accomplish benefit at this time, how could one achieve this perfect treasure in the future? The three realms, that's the realms of form, the formless realm, and it's essentially what ordinary people experience. The three realms are as impermanent as autumn clouds. The births and deaths of beings are like a dance performance, flashing by like lightning in the sky. The lifespan of beings races swiftly like a waterfall over a steep mountain. When the time comes for even a king to depart, neither his riches nor loved ones, relatives and friends will follow. Wherever beings abide, wherever they go, karma alone follows them like a shadow. Karma alone follows them like a shadow. Karma being the results of our actions, and the actions can be major actions like, for example, doing something very helpful for someone, or conversely, murdering someone. Or they can be very, very subtle. Things like a raised eyebrow in a moment. And they all count. And it's so complicated, karma is, because each succeeding moment's action alters previous karma. It's a little bit like a self-guided missile. All we can be assured of is that whatever we do, there will be a result. So, what are we going to do? How are we going to live? And I'd like to share now some of Khandro Rinpoche's words on enlightenment. What is enlightenment? And she writes, enlightenment is not about becoming something or someone else. It is the recognition of our intrinsic human nature, which is absolute truth. This absolute true nature is called Buddha nature. The term Buddha, from the Sanskrit tatat or tathagata, means gone beyond. Going beyond an ignorant state to become completely inseparable from absolute truth, which is our genuine ground. This is the essence of Buddhism and the main focus of our understanding and practice. So, as we said before, it's not about getting into some particular mind state. It's about letting go the surface distortion that can occur in our minds and opening to the deep, profound truth of our being. And when we can do that, when we can live from that, our life is very, very different. Enlightenment goes by many names: absolute truth, nirvana, liberation, freedom from suffering, freedom from ignorance, Buddha mind, true nature of mind, fundamental ground, tathagata garbha, sugata garbha, and nature of suchness as it is, primordial wisdom, emptiness and luminosity, bliss and emptiness, and wisdom and compassion. All of these terms refer to ultimate realization. This is the fruition that brings sentient beings from the state of ignorance to complete freedom. And this is our aspiration as we begin to practice. Never lose touch with this. When the fruition is truly understood, the ground we stand on and the path we walk on must be maintained with the same understanding. And that is also a very important point in practice, one that's not so emphasized in Buddhism these days, and that is that it's not sufficient simply to awaken. We need to bring that awakened mind state to life in everything we do or say or think. Then the karma we create will be positive. But beyond that, it's simply incomplete. It's just a nice memory. If we bring ourselves to awakening, uncover that truth, and then don't live it. It's also the cause of a lot of suffering in Buddhism these days, where some of the teachers in the past have abused their students. Many, many years ago, I was traveling with Harada Shoto Roshi. We were in the kitchen of another Zen teacher outside of San Francisco. And that Zen teacher, whose daughter had been abused by a different Zen teacher, asked the Roshi, how could that Zen teacher have done that? How could they have behaved in that way? If they were a Zen teacher? Well, part of the question remains, how deeply did they practice? And that's really what Harada Roshi's response was. They didn't spend enough time in the monastery. They weren't long enough in the monastery, he said. In other words, their training was incomplete. When we get to a certain point in our training, we don't want to stop. We've seen how far we've come. We've seen that we've opened to mind states we hadn't realized we had. We've seen that we have done things out of dysfunction that we didn't realize we were doing in that way. And we want to become as free of that conditioning as possible in this life. And that is possible. Continue with Khandar Rinpoche. Buddha nature is the heart quality of all sentient beings. It is necessary to recognize this core essence in ourselves as well as in others. Our own basic nature is free from ignorance, grasping, and conceptual judgments. There's no room for illusion or falsity in absolute truth. Because it's inseparable from wisdom and compassion, there's no room for evil, greed, selfishness, ignorance, anger, and attachment. However, until we have completely integrated that mind state of awakening, that awareness, that encounter with our true nature, there are still habit patterns of greed, anger, and delusion that we need to work on, and this is why we need to integrate that awakening experience in our daily life. There's much research going on these days into how the brain works, and it was a major discovery some years back that reversed the original thinking that once we've got an adult brain, there is no possibility of changing it. Now it turns out there's all kinds of possibility of changing it, including changing bad habit patterns and the rest. Or, for that matter, the reverse is also true, sliding down the slippery slope of greed, anger, and delusion, acting out of selfishness, out of self-interest. When we have opened to at least a small degree of the truth of who we are, then changing negative habit patterns is much easier. Moreover, the more we practice, the more we see more clearly, or see clearly to begin with, where we are behaving in ways that are not in keeping with generosity, kindness, compassion, and wisdom. And it is so much easier to change these habit patterns when we can see them. When we do Zen practice, when we are committed to it, at a certain point, the honeymoon period begins to end, and we begin to start seeing our crap, in a nutshell. And at that point, many people are quite dismayed because they feel that what's really happening is that they're becoming bad people. They're becoming worse through the practice rather than better. And that's not really the case. What's actually happening is we're seeing more clearly. And in the seeing more clearly, we're becoming much more aware of our motivations in behavior. Of the tone of voice, for example, that we might be using with somebody and we are a little shocked at the reaction to us because we didn't realize we were using that kind of tone of voice. So this brings to us a wonderful opportunity. Until we can see where we're caught, until we can see where we are acting out of some level of greed, anger, and delusion, there's not much we can do about it. How can we change something we don't even know we need to change or would like to change? But the more we practice, especially with this powerful Sasokan practice, this extended out-breath practice, it's a fast track to opening. And in the part of that opening is opening to a clear view of our life and our behavior. And then we have the gift of being able to move it in compassionate and wise directions. There's no room for illusion or falsity in absolute truth. Because it's inseparable from wisdom and compassion, there is no room for evil, greed, selfishness, ignorance, anger, or attachment. And we need to add, once we are able to open deeply enough to that innate wisdom, then we are able to live much more free from illusion and delusion, anger, greed, selfishness, and so on. This intrinsic ground of goodness is undeniable. All beings appreciate qualities of goodness, wisdom, and compassion, and kindness, because this is our fundamental nature. Being aware of this is one thing. However, maintaining that awareness is something else. The first thing the Buddha taught after his enlightenment was the truth of suffering. the cause of which is ignorance. And it's that ignorance of our true nature. That's the overlay of through conditioning of that perfect beingness that we are. And so we act out of that conditioning instead of out of the innate goodness, the innate perfection, the innate compassion and wisdom that is our true nature. Because of ignorance, we're unable to see the compositeness of our perceptions, all the physical and mental forces that come together to create the seemingly solid world. And this leads to grasping in the endless cycle of suffering called samsara. Samsara and all its suffering begin when we get caught up in solidifying external appearances instead of remaining on our fundamental ground. It was Charlotte Joko Beck, who has since died, who was a therapist as well as a Zen teacher, and a very wise Zen teacher, wrote a couple of books. One is called Everyday Zen. We have a copy of that up at the Kanondo in the library there. And there is another book, that title I don't remember at the moment. And she spoke in one of those books about how, for example, if we're out on a wonderful sunny day on a lake rowing a boat, and all of a sudden, bang, we bump into another boat. We didn't see it coming. And initial reaction is irritation and anger. And then we look and we realize that that boat doesn't have anybody in it. Nobody ran into us. A boat was floating on its own. And of course, then we can translate that into anger at whoever left the boat untied. But maybe nobody did leave the boat untied. Maybe there was a storm and it broke loose of its moorings. This gives an indication of how many different possibilities there are to a way of perceiving something as simple as being out there on the lake, happily rowing away, and then being banged into by another boat. If it's like that with something as simple as that, what is it like with our everyday life? Somebody says something to us in, how do we interpret that? It's guaranteed to be interpretation based on our conditioning, not necessarily on the truth of our existence. And so we get caught in a whirl. Around and around we go, reacting to life. When the more clear we can be, the more we can respond to life. And in that letting go of reactivity in a moment, suddenly many opportunities present themselves. Where we thought we might be in a blind corner, a dead end, somehow, when we aren't invested in the result, other opportunities open up. The way stands clear and undisguised, as it says in Affirming Faith and Mind. The more we can let go, the more we can truly enjoy our life, the more we can live our life in ways that promote peace, joy, and equanimity, not only to ourselves, but to others as well. And the practice, this incredible practice of Sasokan, will take us there faster than any other practice I've either practiced or known about or witnessed other people practicing. It's a phenomenal practice. The challenge is that it's such a simple practice. We can get bored. We can get frustrated. We can feel like there's something else, a different practice that will work much better. But if we're really to gain the benefit of this practice, it's important to stick with it. If boredom comes up, What does boredom taste like? What does boredom feel like in our body? Bring the breath out, exploring that. And always, always reach through the breath. Try to touch that which is just barely out of reach. Over and over again to do this. And now we have really a little bit more than six more days in which to continue deepening in this practice. Take advantage of it. Give yourself fully to it, especially at times when it doesn't feel very productive. At times when it's the last thing in the world you want to do, because that's exactly where the most benefit can come from practicing anyway. I thank you for listening, and we'll now recite the four vows.